Why Philosophical Discussions About Everyday Life is produced by the Institute for Philosophy and Public Life, a division of the University of North Dakota's College of Arts and Sciences. Visit us online at whyradioshow.org.
Hi, welcome to Why Philosophical Discussions About Everyday Life. I'm your host, Jack Russell Weinstein. Today we're talking about disability and philosophy, and how our culture and other philosophers misunderstand how to think about the issues involved. Our guest is Anita Silvers. I want to have a philosophical discussion about disability, but before we begin, it is worth asking how we can philosophize about a subject that is either invisible to most people or deeply embarrassing. It is invisible because we think little of the ramps we walk up or the braille on the ATM. When we use the most obvious reminder of living with a disability, the extra-wide toilet stall in a public restroom, we're either anxious that we're going to be in someone's way who needs it, or relieved that we found a stall big enough to comfortably hang our big coats and heavy work bags. Where to hang your big coat is not a trivial issue in North Dakota. Disability is embarrassing to address because we don't like to call attention to people's impairments or conditions. We're uncomfortable highlighting someone's difference unless we perceive it as positive or worth celebrating. But, of course, whether someone with a disability is to be considered different at all is a philosophical question, and it is unclear whether pathologizing disability is even useful. I've already used the terms impairment and condition in my introduction, and I don't quite know what new information they bring to the table. Also, I've already implied that my audience is looking at disability from afar, not experiencing it. I've actually reaffirmed the invisibility of the disabled while attempting to call attention to them. All of this suggests, first, that we may have to do some psychiatry before we do philosophy. We may have to look at our personal resistance to encountering disability as a normal fact of life. More deeply, though, it also tells us that we'll have to work exceptionally hard to let the disabled speak for themselves. We're used to think of disability in terms of advocacy, in terms of the children with autism who cannot articulate their needs well, or the PTSD-stricken veteran who has been isolated from society. But the latter is an adult with his or her own voice, and the former can communicate in a variety of effective ways. It is us, not them, who aren't paying attention. The tendency to speak for others, it will turn out, is a huge problem in academic philosophy. Even the most egalitarian philosophers have a tendency to assume that people with disabilities are outliers in the social contract, not equal participants. We'll talk about this specifically later on in the show. Their mistake is the same as ours. The vast majority of conversations people have about disability concern our personal reactions to disability rather than engaging with the disabled themselves. And when we finally do get around to doing that, when we ask, for example, about complying with the Americans with Disabilities Act, we focus in on the economic cost. We ask whether having wheelchair-accessible toilets is too much of a burden for small businesses, or whether retrofitting a school is spending too much money on one single interest group. We go from the psychological to the political instantaneously, paying virtually no attention to the meaning of our words, the assumptions we make about what the good life is, or even the diverse nature of personhood. To use a phrase that I learned from today's guest, our discussions about disability are almost always anti-aspirational. That is, they are not about what we, disabled or not, can aspire to, but rather about mitigating the supposed tragedies of bodies, preventing people from what they would otherwise achieve. Most of the discussions I have with my students are about their curiosities and what they hope to accomplish with their studies. But to be frank, the majority of my conversations with students with learning disabilities focus on accommodations, about making special arrangements so they too can do the work. If every interaction one has with somebody is about equalizing the playing field, there is very little opportunity to discuss what life is like after they win. On today's episode, we're going to investigate the nature of disability. We're going to begin by asking what disability means, and then proceed to questions of self-worth, public policy, even the ways in which philosophy itself has skewed our understanding of how to think about people with disabilities. But doing this will require unlearning a great deal. What we think we know about disability is deeply mistaken, profoundly unfair, and more than a little dangerous. To highlight an irony, yes, there are many people in the world with disabilities, but in this case, it is the ones without who are at a disadvantage. And now our guest. Anita Silvers is professor and chair of the philosophy department at San Francisco State University. She's the author, co-author, and editor of many books and articles. She's a nationally recognized advocate for disability rights with a scholarly emphasis on medical ethics, bioethics, social and political philosophy, and feminism. Anita, thanks for joining us on Why.
And thank you, Jack, so much for inviting me. I'm really honored to be on your program and to make a connection with your listeners.
This show is pre-recorded, so we can't accept your emails today, but we would still love to know your thoughts, join the conversation with you in the chat room. So please come to whyradioshow.org, tweet us at whyradioshow, or post on Facebook at facebook.com/whyradioshow. So I guess, Anita, the thing to do is just to start with a very, very basic question. What do we mean when we use the term disability? What is disability?
Well, Jack, you've opened the door for me to disagree with something you said.
Excellent.
A philosopher. It's very hard for me not to. Well, I'm not criticizing. I'm just going to make a suggestion. You talked about us and them as if people with disabilities are rare. As a matter of fact, the last census revealed that one in every five Americans has a disability. So you're quite right when you say that disability is invisible, and when you point out that even for people like me, I'm a quadriplegic, have been since I had polio as a kid. I'm now in my 50th year of teaching, so I've got some experience here. And I can report that when I come into a room or just come down the street with my mobility scooter, that people look away, so they make me invisible too. So the situation is not about a very small number of people. It's about a rather large number of people, one-fifth of our entire population.
Can I ask real quickly, you are, our listeners should know, a fairly prominent philosopher. You've been on the scene a long time. You've written a fair amount of tremendously influential pieces. You also have a fairly public role in the American Philosophical Association, our association, our professional association. Do other philosophers look away too? Even though people know that this is your field and they know, and some of them will know your history, do they still react in that way by making you invisible? Or does the professional context help mitigate it at all?
I'm not sure it's the professional context that helps mitigate it, but philosophers traditionally have been much less interested in bodies than in minds. And I've always felt enormously comfortable in the philosophical profession, and I've never felt as if I'm being excluded or ignored. I remember, for example, when the APA board, I sat on the board for 25 years doing various kinds of tasks. When the APA board met in Pittsburgh and we all had to get on a bus, and I was sitting there looking at those steps and saying to myself, how can I disappear so that I won't bother anybody? And the last people getting onto the bus simply picked me up and put me on the bus and put my mobility scooter on the bus. And nobody said a word. It was just as if nobody thought anyone needed to say, we are going to accommodate you. It's just that I was one of the group and we include everybody who's part of the group. So philosophy was a place, has been a place for me to feel comfortable.
And this normalization of disability, it's actually reasonably common in things like the Social Security Administration. Right? When we talk about disability in that context, we're talking about something very familiar to people, are we not?
Certainly not normalization, if you understand the Social Security system. And normalization is a rather recent notion. It has its origins in the 19th century. It's supposed that we can identify the species-typical kind of body and the species-typical kind of mind, and that individuals who may be biologically human but do not meet those standards of being typical usually are defective. And even if they're not defective, they probably don't belong to the group because they're too good at something or other. So I would never use the word normalization. I spend an awful lot of time, as do some others, trying to point out that normal, that the normal individual is a fiction. But let's get back to your question about what disability means, because it certainly does not mean abnormal. Disability, oddly enough, is a term of art. And what I mean by that is there are different definitions of disability depending on the program or purpose for which one is talking about disability. As I know I've written, the most familiar one, I think, in this country at this moment is the definition of disability that is used by the Social Security Administration for purposes of benefits under the SSDI and SSI programs. Now, what we need to understand about that is that it is work-related and that the entire process of determining whether somebody is disabled or not is focused on showing that the person is an exception, is not typical because they cannot work.
So let me interrupt for just a second, because this connects back to my use of the word normalization. And I love making mistakes on the air, because it helps our listeners know that it's normal to try to figure things out and to be wrong. And so I guess when I said normalization, what I mistakenly meant was that there is a process to deal with it. That's not the right word, when it is encountered. But I guess what you're saying here is that the very existence of a process suggests this exceptional circumstance of it, that it still doesn't become normalized. And the word itself is misleading because, of course, there's no such thing as normal. But it's still having to deal with something that isn't the way the things ought to go.
Well, that's still normative.
Right.
You might say it isn't the way things typically go.
Right, and that's what I'm trying to get at. That's what I'm trying to pull out. The way that I am completely trapped in this misleading normative language. I'm trying to figure out all the mistakes that I'm making so that we can see how the philosophical focus on individual words can help clarify the issues that we need to talk about. So typical and normal are different, and typical and ought to go are different. And the Social Security Administration's definition of disability is a way of dealing with atypical things, but in a way that I gather is still regarded as stigmatizing or negative. Is that a fair assumption?
It's a definition that was developed for a specific purpose, and that is to provide income assistance for working age individuals who, because of matters that are beyond their control, specifically suffering from illness or disease, they can't work. The SSDI program is for people who have been able to work and then have been injured or ill and can no longer do the kinds of work that they did or much other work. The SSI program, which came later, is for people who have not been able to work ever. So the first question one has to ask is not being able to work stigmatizing? Well, one thing I believe, and remember, I'm pretty old, so I come from a cultural background that has its roots in the Depression and World War II. So I was brought up to believe that one really needs to have a work identity. And I cherish my work identity. And I've worked all my life. Although, because I am a quadriplegic, the assumption is often that I can't work. So when I went out on the job market with other people having finished my PhD, looking for a job, I was interviewed several times by individuals who said, she's really too frail to work. That's stigmatizing, mostly because it's false, and they should have known it was false. They should have known it was false because I already had a record of having taught and doing all of the work of a philosophy professor. And in fact, I am at this point working full-time, managing a very large department, and I have been working here for 50 years, which makes me the professor who's lasted longest at San Francisco State. Some people think I ought to be congratulated for that, but many of my colleagues just look at me and say, she must be crazy.
Well, the desire to retire, I think, for all of us fluctuates depending on particular administrative needs. But let me ask, so we have this network of terms that we tend to think of as related. You used illness, you used frail, and then used disabled. And I gather that you would like to disconnect disabled from the other two. I mean, there are some disabled folks who are frail, I am sure, and there are some people who are disabled because they are ill. But this is – they're not the same thing. They're multiple things at once. So how do we have to – if I'm understanding correctly – how do we start to talk about disability without pathologizing it or without giving it false and stigmatizing descriptions?
Well, I think it's pretty simple. We've done this with other groups that used to be described as frail, emotional, unable to work. One of my favorite Supreme Court cases is Clary v. Gossard, 1948. The case was whether or not a state's ban on allowing women to tend bar, even if they owned the bar, was constitutional. Hmm. Women, after World War II, women were banned from doing it. During World War II, because the guy still wanted to get a drink, and there weren't all that many male bartenders around, women were allowed to serve them. Hmm. So the Supreme Court said in that case, sure, it's constitutional because women are too frail to keep order in a bar. And so they cannot, even if they own the bar, tend the bar unless they have a husband or father with them. Couldn't hire anybody, you see. Now, then the court said something very interesting. The court said, yes, we know that science tells us that many women are perfectly able to keep order in a bar. But science is irrelevant. That's a very close paraphrase of what they say. They explicitly say that we're not going to take a look at whether or not women can actually keep order in a bar. That's what's known as stigmatizing. In other words, what you do is attribute to all members of a class, defined in one way, properties that are not necessary to being a member of the class, properties that many members of the class do not have, and properties that are excuses to deny members of the class, all of them, the same opportunities as individuals who are not members of the class. And that is what happens with disability.
I was originally going to ask a question in this form, but I'm going to revise it once I ask it. The original question I was going to ask is there a disabled community the way that some people think there is a deaf community or a blind community? And then we're talking about civil rights, so an African-American community, et cetera. Because there's such a wide range of disabilities that a person can have, is there a community in that sense? But let me back up into that question, specifically to the way that you said, the language that you just used. What is it that makes people with disabilities a single identifiable class? What is it that the law can focus on to regardless as a class issue rather than an individual lawsuit or something like that?
Well, I have argued, and I think people are coming around to my view, that this is not a matter of an identity class. Civil rights should not be a matter of an identity class. Civil rights and how we rectify civil wrongs should not depend on whether or not you can claim to be a member of a class. So you have seen what happens. We have seen what happens and what has happened in the courts with discrimination on the basis of sex. This is one of my favorite stories. I will admit right now that I'm talking about it very fast. I'm omitting some things. But you will recall that initially we thought that the Civil Rights Act, where it applied to matters of sex, was a matter of protecting women against discrimination, right? So you would have to show that you were a woman in order to claim that you've been subject to sexual discrimination. Well, that didn't hold up very long. It didn't hold up, and there were some classic cases. I'll tell you about two of them. One of the most important was a case in which an individual who was locked up on an oil rig with other employees was subjected to harassment that was sexual in nature. I'll let your imagination figure that one out. But that individual happened to be a male. He claimed that he had been discriminated against in regard to sex, and the court said yes. My favorite, however, is a case that had to do with the with hiring a person, an historian, to be the curator of military history in the National Archives. The individual who the board wanted to hire was an ex-military man, wonderful record. They were thrilled. He had all the qualifications. And he came for the final interview. And the chair of the board was all ready. But
Anita, I'm gonna leave this as a cliffhanger for just a second, and because we have to take a break, and this ensures that everyone comes back.
It's a story worth coming back for.
Excellent. You're listening to Why Philosophical Discussions About Everyday Life. I'm your host, Jack Russell Weinstein. We're talking with Anita Silvers. We'll be back after this.
The Institute for Philosophy and Public Life bridges the gap between academic philosophy and the general public. Its mission is to cultivate discussion between philosophy professionals and others who have an interest in the subject, regardless of experience or credentials. Visit us on the web at philosophyandpubliclife.org. The Institute for Philosophy and Public Life, because there is no ivory tower.
You're back with Why Philosophical Discussions About Everyday Life. I'm your host, Jack Russell Weinstein. We're talking with Anita Silvers about disability and philosophy. And we'll get right back into it like they do on two-part television series. I'll say when last we met, there was a candidate for a position as lead historian in a historical in a military history museum. He had an outstanding record, and it was his final interview. And now we return to the story.
Story was that the chair of the board called him in for a final interview and was going to offer him, I think he was an ex-Marine, was going to offer him the job, and they were thrilled. He showed up in stockings, lipstick, and high heels and said, I'm undergoing a sex transition, and I just wanted you to know what I will be like when I'm on the job. As I'm sure you could have guessed, they withdrew the job offer. He went to court, and the court said, I think it was in a D.C. court, the court said, was this sex discrimination or not? Well, we know this had something to do with sex. So we're going to say it was sex discrimination. So notice that this is no longer a matter of who is in the class of women and who isn't in the class of women. It's about what's really at root in sex discrimination, and that is adverse treatment on the basis of somebody's being perceived as being of the wrong sex, whatever the wrong sex happens to be in the context. So now when we go to disability, what I have argued is that unlike Social Security benefits, which are an entitlement for some people, civil rights for people with disabilities do not depend on whether one can prove one is disabled or not. The issue is always, is there an opportunity to participate in a good that is offered by society? And is a person being denied that opportunity? That is there an unlevel playing field on the basis of a physical or mental difference that does not infect their ability to participate, but is because of some kind of fantasy or stigma?
You know, it's an incredibly interesting example because I think it highlights very well how discrimination and stigmatization works. Because, and I'll use the language of the Marines here, because if I recall, he was a Marine former Marine. Here is a person who believed it was honorable to be as honest as possible about how, I'm not sure whether to say he or she at this stage in the transition process, as to how he or she was going to be in the job. Right? The person who was offered the job was showing incredibly virtuous character. I am not going to surprise you. I am going to give you truth in advertising. I am fully informing you so that you can make the decision. And they saw that as a negative as opposed to the kind of thing that everyone would absolutely want as an employee. As an employer. So I guess the shift from the class-based understanding to an individual is a way of showing what it means for there to be relevant characteristics. Honesty, integrity, honor, truth in advertising, so to speak. Those are all relevant to a job employment, whether someone is wearing lipstick or a dress, presumably not.
Well, that's part of it. But from my point of view, the bottom line here was that this person was their only candidate, as I recall, who not only was a qualified historian, an archivist, but also had enormous military experience. Mm-hmm. They had nobody else like that. That person, in their view, for those reasons, the ones I just gave, could do the job better than any other candidate. Then we need to ask, so what did what he was wearing have to do with his being able to do the job? Nothing. What did whatever sex he happened to be at the moment, or whatever sexual identity he had, have to do with his doing the job? Nothing. And that is basically the issue for discrimination against people with disabilities. Many of us can do jobs. Many of us can document that we can do jobs or have other opportunities, which I'll talk about in a minute. But that we may look different or do the job different stigmatizes us and reduces our opportunities. And that is exactly what is not right and what is what I call a civil wrong. So the ADA is often thought of incorrectly as providing special entitlements, privileges for people with disabilities. There is no privilege involved. If we use public money, or if we are running an organization that depends on public money, fire protection, police protection, etc., then we should be making opportunities for participation, whether it's work or recreation, available equally to all those who can participate. I don't see what kind of defense there would be against that kind of claim. But often we've just ignored, as you pointed out in your introduction, we've just ignored the fact that not all people mobilize alike, read alike, etc.
Is the language of accommodation that university offices of disability services utilize, is that misleading in the sense that it emphasizes... I don't know what the word is. Sometimes it feels to some people as if it's some sort of remediation. And so is thinking about giving students with, say, learning disabilities or students who have other particular needs, accommodating their disability, is this also a wrong way to think about it? And part of what I'm getting at is, you know, someone like the late Justice Scalia really believed that you just look at the Constitution, and when you interpret the law, there is no moral component. There is simply a constitutional component. But the stuff that you're talking about really shows that the law is both legal, right, jurisprudential, and also moral in nature. And so I guess part of what I'm getting at is, does the language of accommodation slip in a moral claim under the bureaucratic procedure? Or is that language fine and neutral, and the only negative connotation is how people think about the word individually?
Well, accommodation simply means making alterations so people can have equal access. I don't know whether that is a moral claim or a political claim, but it's certainly an equalizing claim. We make the same kinds of... We assign the same kinds of responsibilities, including the payment of taxes to people with disabilities, then we should not be turning around and saying, you've met all of our criteria for being a citizen, but you're not enough of a citizen to be able to enjoy those benefits of being a citizen that everybody else has. Now, for me, the key to all of this is it possible? And this is actually the way the ADA and the ADAAA are written. Is it possible to reorganize things so that there is equitable access? Is the absence of equitable access just because people with disabilities have been invisible? We don't want to think about them. They are not well represented politically, and so on. Commenting on Justice Scalia's view, I'm certainly not a legal theorist, although I do publish in that area sometimes. One of the things that I've written shows that exactly that view was used to deny desegregated schools all through the 19th century, but especially in the early part of the 19th century. So, yes, you could always ring in that kind of argument as a justification for denying people access. So I always think about access and accommodation is simply a way of reorganizing so that people have equal access. The learning disability issue is one that, if I may sound inelegant, has just been totally screwed up. So now, think of me as one college professor talking to another college professor.
I'm okay with that.
What happens here is that accommodation to people with learning disabilities is made to look as if it's a privilege for them. But what is it that's such an accommodation? Usually, it's about having more time to take a test, etc. Because if you have dyslexia, you're going to probably read slower if you're reading test items, etc. So what happens is that it seems as if standards are being, which is false, it seems as if standards are being lowered to accommodate people with learning disabilities who are asking, let's say, for double time for tests because they just read slower. They read accurately. It's just that they have some wiring that shifts things around. For all we know, that wiring is a benefit and would make them better at some things that are not reading things. So then we ask, well, are they being given an unfair advantage? But then we professors really need to be able to justify the claim that having more time on a test improves people's grades. As it happens, there's a lot of evidence that it does not. A professor who knows what he or she is doing is going to give students the typical time that it would take for them to write the answers, assuming they know the material. I don't know if you have ever had any students, Jack, who don't know the material.
Well, you know, North Dakota students, they're pretty perfect in every way. No effort is expended in pedagogy at all.
But maybe once in a while,
yeah,
somebody
right.
does.
Just to keep myself in
and
shape.
Let me ask you a question. If the person doesn't know the answers, doesn't know the material, we're giving them more time to not know the material and to demonstrate it, improve their grade.
You know, that I mean, it's such a tremendously obvious point, but it's a really important one that never occurred to me, right? I mean, it's one of those things, right, like many philosophical truths, right? Once you learn it, it never occurred to you before. It's so obvious that I'm never going to not think about it in that way before. No student is going to make an answer that they don't know appear out of nowhere, whether they have an extra 15 minutes or 15 hours. Sitting at the desk, they're not going to do it, right? John Locke, right,
exactly.
Talks about this. He says, it's impossible to say you know something and have forgotten it at the same time, right? That's not knowledge. So I love this idea of thinking about it in terms of reorganization, right?
So let me now say more that goes on here.
Okay.
But some of the considerations that we have when we give an exam are practical, right?
Right.
We only have so much time in the classroom. So what do we do about that? There are also students who find it hard to concentrate. They're hypersensitive to noise, etc. What they would like is a quiet room. Do you happen to have quiet rooms at your command? No, I don't. So what is asked of the professor is, will you give me an accommodation? I need a quiet room. I need more time. And the professor actually may not be able to provide those resources because you got to cover the material. and your class takes the test, and then you got to get them out of there for the next class, right?
Right. So it's at the service of the institution or at the service of the professor, not at the service of the student.
Right. But more important than for me is that most professors, I actually have a way of handling this, but most professors don't have the ability to make these arrangements. Mm-hmm. And therefore, they're very locked into the way they're doing it, being the only way. And they're thinking that having more time might even give an advantage to a student, which, of course, if you look at the empirical data, we can show that does it. Also, one other thing that in the area of learning disability, I'm going to be inelegant again, drives me nuts about how universities respond, how everybody responds, is whether or not the person has been tested.
Right.
So some universities require testing at the time the student comes to college, regardless of whether they've been tested before. It's very expensive. San Francisco State students don't have that money.
Just for our listeners, we're talking about testing to legitimize a claim of learning disability. So a student comes to a professor and says, I have dyslexia, I have attention deficit disorder, I am ultra sensitive to various different things. We are required by law to make these accommodations or reorganize so that students can have the same access to knowledge and testing as everyone else. And so what we're talking about is that some universities require testing for the students to prove or to legitimize their claims as if a student is going to walk up and lie and say they need this for personal advantage.
Well, actually, not quite, because first of all, it's not testing to legitimize the claim. It's testing to identify.
Oh, so they're diagnostic.
Right, they're
not
diagnostic.
Okay.
They're therefore beyond the student's ability. But these will be students typically who were tested when they were younger. But now the university wants them tested again, which they would have to pay for, usually. On the other hand, the Bar Association recently, and perhaps still, insists that to get accommodations on the bar exam, you have to have been tested when you were young. See, exactly the opposite. And that's on the theory that you can't have just developed a learning disability, even though you may just have been diagnosed with it.
You know, I have a student right now who's struggling with this in terms of getting accommodations for the GRE. But I want to ask you about a very graphic example that I think talks very clearly about this sense of reorganization and the way that the blindness of institutions can work. Will you talk a little bit about the example you cite in an upcoming paper in the journal Res Publica about a boarding school in Russia that had a fire? It's a tremendously sad story, but it's an incredibly informative one.
Well, it's the kind of story that is used in ways that makes me extremely angry. So there are some philosophers who want to define disability as necessarily disadvantageous. When you define disability that way, you undercut claims, aspirational claims of disabled people to be able to have a status in society that doesn't disadvantage them. So you undercut claims to remedy social disadvantage. And of course, this is just a definition. I've just been actually looking at another article coming out of the same group of philosophers. I don't know whether they're going to publish it or not, which defines mild intellectual disability. Defines mild intellectual disability as being unable to understand that if you eat 25 donuts every day that that will be bad for you.
Well, there goes the entire American public.
Whoa, no. Whoa. The point of the article is to say that if a person is mildly intellectually disabled, that person, the society, is justified in preventing the person from eating 25 donuts. But if a person eats 25 donuts every day and is not intellectually disabled, then we can be sure they're judging competently, and we should not intervene.
I don't want to go down this rabbit hole because I want there to be time for this discussion.
Okay, but let me go on to the Russian.
Yeah, I just want to touch upon for those folks who are interested in the history of philosophy. This seems to me to call back to Plato's most central question: does anyone make moral mistakes knowingly? Right? Plato thought that Plato had Socrates in the dialogues say that if someone is doing something wrong, it's because they don't know any better. Whereas other people would suggest, no, you can know better and still make moral mistakes. But, so assuming, perhaps falsely, that eating 25 donuts every day is a moral mistake, this is that debate.
Me, the problem with this is that many people who are mildly intellectually disabled know perfectly well.
Right, of course.
That this is bad for them. And they probably know it in exactly the same way as people who have not been diagnosed as intellectually disabled. They've been told it. So for me, the problem is that when you define disability as being in all sorts of deficits that many people with disabilities are not, then you've given the game away. You've said such people can never make good use of access. So that's my first problem. And the group that I associate with arguments of this sort, not having made that particular argument, but with arguments of this sort, have argued in print that in the case of a Russian school for the deaf that had a fire, that the children died in the fire because they needed each to be awakened individually, and then sign language had to be used to tell them where to go, how to get out, and that was all too slow. And that shows that their being deaf was a disadvantage that was responsible for their diet. I was horrified when I read this because, as I say in the article that you've read that's forthcoming, not at all. Note, first of all, that there was and is a social organization in that particular country that takes children with disabilities away from their homes and places them in these kinds of institutions, as we used to do in the early 20th and throughout the 19th century. Second of all, there is a fire alarm, very simple, required by the ADA, lights that turn on and off in order to tell people that there is an alarm. Deaf people can see those. But you've got to say what they mean, and you've got to be able to switch the lights on and off. Pretty easy to do. More important, there is something called a fire drill. Those of us who work at universities probably are familiar with them, since, of course, any time that I'm planning to give a test, suddenly in the middle of the class, the fire drill starts and everybody has to leave the room. But fire drills are required in this country for anything like a school, certainly for a sleepover school, and they never had any. So it was not, in my view, their disability, their deafness, that was responsible for for the children's being killed. What was responsible was a social organization that thought these children were so less worthy than others that they were taken away from home and were placed in an institution that did not even take precautions of the simplest sort. And I'm really shocked that any philosophers would be so, would miss the mark so much and be so intent on proving that disability is disadvantageous. And I understand why they're doing it, which I may mention in a minute.
That was going to be my next question. What is the incentive to define disability in this way?
Pretty simple. Many philosophers have made this argument. The incentive is that if we don't think that disability is disadvantageous, we will cease to put as much money into medical means of preventing the kinds of things that create disability. Now, first of all, I think that's nonsense. It still won't be easy to be disabled.
Right.
But second of all, it is that thinking that has led to eugenics programs, of which we know a great deal. And as I constantly say to my classes, when we talk about the eugenics programs in Nazi Germany, I say, where do they get the idea? Which is well known. Remember, I'm teaching this in San Francisco. And eventually one of my students realizes that the program of eugenics from which the Nazis got the idea was a California program.
Hmm. I didn't know that.
You should take my, well, my student, all my students know this.
The commute would be hard, but I'd be willing to do it.
but the reason for those programs, and in those days, they really could not distinguish between inherited disabilities and adventitious disabilities. So they just got everybody and sterilized them. But the reason was supposed to be that such persons were burdens on themselves and on society. So as long as we are focused on pouring in money to prevent disabilities, then we are headed for eugenics programs. This is not to say that prevention is not appropriate. And I say again, that is because being disabled is not easy. I'm not one of these people who says, gee, I'm so happy I'm disabled, because there's a lot of hard work I have to do just because of that. By this time, I'm not sure whether I mind the work or not. I'm so used to it. So I believe that we can look neutrally at people who are disabled and not presuppose or suppose by definition that people who are disabled are inferior and naturally and inescapably disadvantaged. So it's fine. But I also think that is compatible with saying that we should use medical resources to prevent the kinds of illnesses and injuries that can lead to disability.
So just if I'm understanding, to summarize, you had told us earlier that I don't know the proper grammar. You became quadriplegic as a result of polio. You are not suggesting that we shouldn't have cured polio. You're just suggesting that just because you got polio and there were these consequences doesn't mean that you weren't fully capable of doing all of the things that you're capable of. Your life wasn't ruined. It's not a miserable experience. It's just something that happened. Polio should be cured if it can be cured. But if people get polio and have these consequences, they're not inferior and they shouldn't be stigmatized because of it.
Right. Well, actually, we prevent it. We can't cure it, but sure, right. Absolutely.
Yeah.
It's much better to prevent these things. But sometimes, or let me put it this way, if we cannot for every individual do the much better thing, that doesn't mean we should abandon them, ignore them, make them invisible, and prevent them from full participation and, of course, full contribution in the ways that they can, because the root for me or the ground for me, I'm not good at talking about philosophical ground. Sometimes I don't even understand what we're talking about. But what does seem to me to be the bottom line here is that we all interact with one another, and that a society, the strongest kind of society, the most stable kind of society, is a society that has respectful places for very, very different kinds of people.
So let me pull the political philosophy thread here that comes from this discussion of pluralism and respect and equality. And let me ask you a question which has a little bit of a technical explanation for folks who haven't had a lot of philosophy, which is you're involved in a discussion about the social contract. And the basic idea of a social contract, and there are different versions of it from John Locke to Thomas Hobbes and Jean-Jacques Rousseau to more modern notions, that society is an agreement between equals, and that the structure of the government and the structure of the society is the result of this agreement that is hashed out as a contract. And it can be taken literally by some philosophers and it can be taken metaphorically by others. Historically, what people have said, including the most famous modern social contract theorist, John Rawls, what people have said is that folks who are disabled have to be advocated for. They are outliers. And that also Rawls said something similar. He said that not everyone in the family participates in the social contract, just the head of the household participates in the social. Could you talk a little bit about how this relates to disability and advocacy and the stuff that we're talking about? Why does the model of the social – how does the model of the social contract that almost everyone alludes to in passing and that philosophers deal with in quite detail, how is that related to the questions of philosophy and disability?
Let's see. There is a traditional notion of the social contract going back, I suppose, to Locke, although this may be – the tradition may misread Locke, maybe even, probably even further back. And that is that this is a contract or agreement among individuals in a society – each of whom is bargaining with the others. And they're bargaining with the others in order to delineate what each will contribute and what each will get back for contributing. So this is a model that, at least in my view, makes much too much of adversarial bargaining. I happen to be in a university that has collective bargaining. I know what adversarial bargaining is, in which we see our interests as possibly incompatible with one another, and we're looking for a social organization that will serve all our interests. And so presumably we're looking for interests that we all have in common.
So following John Locke, the social contract is designed to take people who have all their own individual interests and get them together to bargain so that they can make the best deal for themselves while also recognizing that other people are trying to do the same
right.
thing.
Except that, as Martha Nussbaum points out, explaining Rawls and being uncomfortable with what he says, people with disabilities traditionally have been thought not to be able to participate, either because we have nothing to contribute or because for many people with disabilities, particularly those with intellectual disabilities, they just don't have the capacity to bargain, to reason, to come to see what we have in common, because that takes advanced reasoning abilities. Now, what I have argued is that this model of society is not a very good one. It certainly does not align with what we're looking for in a society, what Rawls says we're looking for, and that's stability. For Rawls, You get stability from fairness in the society, fair organization of the society, which is fair. And of course, if you only are fair to some people, you're probably going to be much less stable. That's not Rawls. What I have argued, and I argued this more than a decade ago, is that the bargaining model, the adversarial bargaining model, with each individual against every other individual, trying to get the best deal for him or herself, until we finally get down to what will the bottom line, whatever we can put together that satisfies all or most people who are bargaining. What I've said is no, what's really crucial to a stable society is trusting each other. And when we are looking for a society, when we're trying to have a society built on trust, and I take trust to be absolutely crucial, to be very important. Trust for a person with a disability is so important, because so often I have to rely on trusting others. If I go to a restaurant with my friends and I say to them, can I get in my mobility scooter? I have to trust that the people who tell me I can don't say when I get there, oh, well, they're just these few little steps. It's so hard. So trust is enormously important. And people with disabilities contribute to a climate of trust.
And isn't there a reciprocal trust that is lacking, too, that traditionally people look at folks with disabilities as untrustworthy in the sense they can't do the job, they're frail, to use earlier example, that it's not just that you have to trust your friends, but that people have to trust that you are a whole person with your own capabilities, and that if there is a job that you're qualified to do, you are qualified to do it and you can do it.
Well, they don't have to trust that I'm a whole person. They just have to trust that I'm a person who can do whatever it is that I am agreeing to do. But you're absolutely right. People with disabilities have been stigmatized in literature as devious and angry. Think about, I think they're, I was just watching an old television show set in the 19th century, and there is a person with dwarfism who is the demon or evil person. And if you go through literature, it's from the 19th century on, it's very common to find people like me characterized as so angry for some reason or other that we are harmful to others. That's all part, I think you're right, part of it is fear. Part of it is the inability of individuals who don't have a particular physical deficit or cognitive deficit, fear that the person who has a deficit won't be able to do the job or the task. That's only because they can't imagine how it would be done if they couldn't do it their way. And that's where we get back to normalization or typical functioning, with which you started off, because it's so hard for people who don't have a disability. So we'll talk about the 4/5 of the population who don't have a disability. They just can't imagine how one could get certain things done if one doesn't do them in the way that they do them.
So we're running out of time, but this is a really good place to circle around and go back, because we started talking about typical behaviors and lack of understanding, and the conversation focused very much on the definition of disability and how the definition of disability is going to preordain, so to speak, the difficulties that come, and it's you called it a term of art. But we've gone to the point where if I understand you correctly, what you're suggesting is that it's not just the definition of disability that's relevant here, but it's actually the very definition of society. It's how we judge what a good society is. It's how we imagine society is put together, and that there's something so flawed about the bargaining model of society that moves away from, say, the trust model of society, that the issue is so deep that we can't stop at the very definition of disability. We have to go through our very understanding of what society itself is and what we expect of it.
I think that's absolutely right. And this is why I say that there is no such thing as special disability rights. There may be entitlements under programs, but the rights that people with disabilities seek are civil rights that are rights for everybody. They are rights of fair participation. What I take to be at the root of this and what we really must, at this moment in our history, come around to reconciling is how we respond to people who are different from ourselves. And whether or not society is set up just for some imagined typical person, or whether we build into our social mechanisms the kind of resilience and flexibility that can make the most of everybody's potential. So that's been the heart of what I do and what I've worked on for 50 years.
Well, I have to tell you, Anita, this has been one of those episodes where it's not just that I learned a tremendous amount. It's that I can look at any individual minute of our conversation and be overwhelmed by the new information that I am going to have to come to terms with, and that I think our listeners are going to enjoy really exploring. So thank you so much for joining us on Why.
Well, thank you so much, Jack. This has been wonderful. I've enjoyed it immensely. And I don't know. As I said, I've only been up in Fargo a little bit. But is it okay if I wish you good weather?
You can wish all you want. I'm not sure it's going to help. But we had, you know, I will say that we had 14 inches of snow in the last couple of days. We had a couple terrible blizzards that shut down the school in the town, which almost never happens. And as I was walking here to the show, thinking about, you know, how you have to be the most agile athlete, which I am not, to not fall and crack a bone, I was thinking about how much harder it would be if I had some sort of disability, wasn't a social commitment to making a path and to helping one another and recognizing that it is part of our social responsibility to make sure that everyone can walk down or roll down or what have you, a path together to go to the same place. That if this weather meant that you couldn't teach, or that you couldn't be a guest on the show, or that someone else in the circumstance couldn't go to their job or go to class, that would be, and this is absolutely the right term, I think, that would be a profound injustice.
That's right. I'll go along with that.
Well, again, thank you so much for joining us on Why. You have been listening to Jack Russell Weinstein on Why Philosophical Discussion of Everyday Life. Our guest, India Silvers, is a professor at San Francisco State University, and we'll be right back after this.
Visit IPPL's blog, PQED, Philosophical Questions Every Day, for more philosophical discussions of everyday life. Comment on the entries and share your points of view with an ever-growing community of professional and amateur philosophers. You can access the blog and view more information on our schedule, our broadcasts, and the Why Radio Store at www.philosophyandpubliclife.org.
You're back with Why Philosophical Discussions About Everyday Life. I'm your host, Jack Russell Weinstein. We've been talking about disability and philosophy and the way to think about it. And, you know, when you first started listening to me, I was trying to be very, very careful. I wanted the right words. I wanted the right sense of how to speak about the right thing. And it became very clear that I didn't know what those were. That attention to language and attention to politeness was getting in the way of just having a great conversation. In the end, I feel like Anita and I parted not only as friends, but as joint interlocutors, that we could laugh, that we could joke, and that whatever mistakes I made were fine because we were looking at the same thing. And that's where the trust comes in, the trust that she talks about, the trust that matters so much. That's what it looks like when two people engage one another, not about their disability or not, but about their ideas and about their equality. We have spent too much time focusing on disability in and of itself and not about the way that society needs to be organized so that we can all contribute as best as we can. You've been listening to Jack Russell Weinstein on Why Philosophical Discussions About Everyday Life. As always, it's an honor to be with you.
Why is funded by the Institute for Philosophy and Public Life, Prairie Public Broadcasting, and the University of North Dakota's College of Arts and Sciences and Division of Research and Economic Development. Skip Wood is our studio engineer. The music is written and performed by Mark Weinstein and can be found on his album Lua y Sol. For more of his music, visit jazzfluteweinstein.com or myspace.com/Mark Weinstein. Philosophy is everywhere you make it, and we hope we've inspired you with our discussion today. Remember, as we say at the Institute, there is no ivory tower.